You're listening to the ILFD podcast, where we take a dive into the International Literature Festival Dublin archives and share some of our favorite conversations from years past. Today, we're listening to Irish writer and comedian Maurice Gaughan talk about her book Trouble for the 25th anniversary edition of the festival in 2022. This episode does contain strong language and mentions of suicide, sex, and substance abuse, and may not be appropriate for young listeners.
Hello. Whoa, that was too much. Okay. Hello. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I don't know if there'd be, like, two people, but there's, like, more than that. Okay, I'm so nervous to talk about the book because I've never talked about it, like, publicly to people, but I'm going to do it. Okay, clap if you've read the book. I don't know how insider baseball to get, so... Oh my God, you frauds. Thank you. Okay, I mean, I'm so bad at explaining it because I feel like when I explain it, it sounds really grim. It's a coming of age memoir and it's about suicide. There's a lot of suicide, not a lot of suicide. The topic is talked about a lot in it. It's about my dad who was mentally ill, who killed himself. And it's about my, like, spiral into destruction and my mental health problems. But it's not grim. Like, that sounds grim, what I've just given there. It's not. I think it's, like, an entertaining read. I wrote it not last August, the August before that. I moved to the south of France, and I wrote it in about a month, the first draft of it. I wrote it drunk. I did. I mean, I talk about my drinking problems in this, but the book ends with me still drinking. I don't drink now. I'm sober. So everything I say now, you don't have to be weird about. People get weird about alcoholism. I see some people clutching their drinks thinking I'm going to steal it. I won't. But I did. I wrote this drunk. I thought it was like a real Hemingway. Like I would sit out in the courtyard with my cigarettes and my two bottles of wine typing away. And usually my editor would just delete like the last 500 words of whatever I'd wrote that night because like it would be nonsense by the end. But the book came out of it. I found out I was an alcoholic when I was living over there. I suppose you always kind of know, but you do this mental gymnastics in your head to convince yourself. And I was like, would an alcoholic write a book? So it really stopped me, you know, getting help for a while. I was like, look how productive I am with it. I'd send my mom a text being like, I love you. And I was like, would an alcoholic do that? And then I went to the doctor. I was getting my heart checked out because I was drinking every day and I got really into like the subreddit groups of alcohol. And so they would give you all these like diseases that you were going to get. So I got really paranoid about them. So I kept going to the doctors about stuff. And I went to this heart doctor and it was this like really good looking Spanish guy. And there's a test they do on you to tell if you're an alcoholic, just to warn some of you guys. They ask you questions. They're like, how often do you drink? Do you drink in the morning? Do you regret when drinking? Have you ever commented a fire emoji on a shirtless photo of a guy on Instagram and then realized it was your brother's Instagram? So real quickly deleted it, but he still got the notification, so now Christmas is weird. Just the basics. But they don't ask you those questions outright because you'd figure out what they're doing, you know? He made it seem like we're having this, like, friendly, chill conversation. So I was lying there. I had my bra off. And look, you guys can't tell because they're contained in this jumper and they're small. But I have some of the messiest, stupidest tits you've ever met. My tits are so dumb, I'm not joking. Like, my tits pronounce the G in lasagna. This one's like back in my armpit. I've no idea what it's doing back there, eating on a crayon or something. And this one just begins the day pointing down and slowly moves its way up. But my big issue is I've got really big nipples. Like small boobs, but big nips. Way too much like nipple per tit. We're talking like a one-to-one ratio. They sort of look like a Jaffa cake on top of a slightly larger Jaffa cake. So I was lying there and I was feeling really insecure about these. And I was like, this is so embarrassing. This guy is so attractive. But then I was thinking, like, he's a heart doctor, right? He must see boobs every single day. Like, regular boobs are probably like M&Ms to this guy. Not that interesting. But then when a limited edition M&M comes out, like pistachio flavored. So I'm now feeling really confident. He's like rubbing that doctor's lube all over me. And then he starts asking me all these like flirty questions. You know, he's like, oh, what's your favorite drink? How many units do you drink every day? What bars do you like to go to? And I was lying there being like, dude, are you flirting with me? He ran over and was typing away in his laptop. And I think he's typing like, is it Google or is it legal to fall in love with a patient? But he told me I was an alcoholic. Yeah, so that was last summer. I didn't stop drinking then. You can't stop when you just find that out. It would be like getting a promotion and quitting the next day. Like, you gotta reap the benefits for a bit. But I stopped drinking in January this year. I went to rehab. Has anyone listened to the audiobook? Yeah, okay, could you hear me struggling? I recorded that the 4 days before I went into rehab. That last 25%, I had a sick bucket in the recording room. It was grim, but the producer was loving it because he was like, this is like Trouble in live action, as I was vomiting. So yeah, rock bottom there. But I went to rehab. It was a real nice one. It was like a priory in the UK. It was really, really nice. 30 days in there. Yeah, people were in there with like all sorts of addictions. It wasn't just alcoholics. There was people in there with sex addiction. There was a guy in there with a masturbating addiction. And like, I would have thought like masturbating is like the gateway drug and sex addiction is like the worst one. But he was really passionate about how masturbating was actually the worst addiction to have because your hand is like always attached to you. So it would be like having heroin at the end of your arm all the time. And then there was a guy in there who was there for heroin and he was like, nah, dude, I've got two hands. They're nothing like heroin. It was a real experience. It was, okay, so it was, you had 8 hours of therapy every day for 30 days. It was super intense. Like, they just break you down in there and, like, change the way you think about things. And the therapists were amazing. All the therapists in the Priory are former addicts, which I think is really good. Like, the best football coaches are former players. Thought that was going to get a laugh. You live and you learn, I suppose. But yeah, it's like an insular bubble though in there because like you're not in your real life. So, you know, I really bought into all the stuff that they said in there. And I had gone to AA before and it's in the book. I'm going to read that chapter in a minute. But this time it like really got through to me and I was like all on board with it. And then you get out and like regular life gets in the way a bit, but like I'm still, I hate sobriety. I fucking hate it, but it's like the best option that I have. You know that quote about democracy where they're like, democracy is the worst form of government except for every other government that I've tried. That's how I feel about sobriety. It's like the worst form of living except for every other type of living I've tried. Like it's the only thing that I can do right now, but I fucking hate it. It's so hard. It's so hard not to drink. I'm doing AA, and yeah, it's difficult. Okay, I've got 3 AA jokes. I'm going to do them. And then I'll read from it. Then I won't do any more little jokes. okay, so I've been doing AA since I got out. I'm not counting the days. I don't like that. I feel like when you start doing that, you get into like a very binary way of thinking. So I'm not counting my days, but I do AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. Although I went to a meeting. This is joke number one. I went to a meeting the other day. It was in a gym, and they made us sign in. So there goes that second day. Just alcoholics. The other two are similar vibe. Okay, what's the other? Okay, the slogan of AA. Love the slogan of AA. It's take one day at a time. I think that's such a good way to live life. Because before this, I was doing 2 days at a time. Yeah, that's not great. So I'm doing like they say to do a meeting every day for the first 90 days, and so I'm doing that, getting really into it, loving going to the meetings, getting like a little bit addicted. Think I'm gonna have to start going to AAA. Okay, I'm done. Okay, I'm gonna read the chapter on AA. So I first did AA when I was living in LA, and it was during like a destructive period of my life. But now I'm kind of at the state where I say that about a lot of my life. But this was, it was about a year after my dad died. I was crazy depressed all the time. And I had this like weird mentality that because he did it, it was like almost a legacy and it meant I was going to do it. And I became certain of this. I was like, I'm going to 100% kill myself. And so believing that, I was like, I might as well just do whatever I want now because it's not going to count. And so I did some mad things. I'll talk more about that, the stuff I did later. But I tried AA over there. It didn't stick that time, but I mean, the good thing about AA, it's always there. Like, you could have a stamp on your head saying fuck AA and they'll still welcome you in if you just have a desire to stop drinking. Okay, so this was my first experience of it. The only entry requirement of AA is that you have to have a desire to stop drinking, but they don't do a lie detector test. They just believe you if you say it. Even though I've decided to stop drinking, I don't actually feel the desire to quit burning through me. Instead, I feel like I'm trying it on for size, wearing the dress of sobriety but keeping the tag on, tucked inside, just in case. When I walk into the stuffy warm room on the third floor of a crumbling building on Sunset Boulevard, I take the seat nearest the exit and make a plan to dip if it gets too weird. Unlike Scientology, I tried Scientology for a bit, very briefly. Just one meeting. Unlike Scientology, AA is free. They don't charge you to attend. Anyone can take a seat and there's no membership due. Everyone who works there is a volunteer. There's no hierarchy, no CEO of AA. They designed it that way. They knew that people love power, so if they gave them the chance, someone would try and become the Jeff Bezos of drunks. So they made it a rule that you can't. At that first meeting, 5 minutes before it officially even begins, when my head is beating into my chest with a brewing hangover, I'm approached by a man who is either my age or 65. It's tough to decipher through his unwashed beard and army jacket. I'm really bad at like doing impressions, so do you know what? Anyone that talks, they're just going to sound like me. I haven't seen you here before, man, he eventually pushes out of his mouth. No, this is my first time, I say while looking at the wall behind him. A good way to get someone to shut up is by never addressing their face. This shit, Ed, he wanders off for a few seconds, nodding to himself. All right, this shit saved my life, dude. I nod politely and continue looking at the wall. I'm sure I can make out the shape of a cat from the pieces of paint that have fallen away. Take my phone number and call me anytime. That's him. I snap back to attention. This motherfucker really has the audacity to hit on me in an AA meeting. Is nowhere sacred anymore? I now look directly into the eyes of this dirty hippie. No, thank you, I hiss. I can't act either. Like, I don't know what hissing is. Okay. Jesus Christ, do you have no decency? He meanders off without taking offense. And after another two meetings, I learn that it's just a part of AA. Everyone gives each other their number and everyone texts each other to check in. AA is big on support systems. No one person can beat their demons by themselves. Nobody is trying to fuck. They're just trying to save. AA is also anonymous. I'm still not sure what that means. Every sober person I meet tells me they're in AA. There is a Bible of AA. It's called the Big Blue Book. It gives the history of AA and the 12 steps to recovery. You're supposed to study the Big Blue Book like you would the gospel. AA technically isn't Christian. Your higher power can be anything. It can be your mother or a tree. But it works best if it's God. AA isn't religious technically, but it is holy. And there's nothing more holy than God. When you introduce yourself during a meeting, you have to follow your name with, "And I'm an alcoholic." And then everybody says hi back. I don't know if that's a written rule, but everyone does it, so you have to too. I think it's so there are no accidental show-ups. Maybe once somebody showed up who thought it was a cancer support group. It's like when you fly and you're boarding the plane and you have to show your boarding pass to the flight attendant, even though you wouldn't have gotten through the gate without having it. It's just a double check. Someone facilitates the meeting, like an MC or a priest, and they change who that is every meeting, so no one person can hog the limelight for too long. They start the meeting with some ground rules. Then they ask if anyone wants to say anything. If you're attention-seeking, like I am, you throw up your hand and walk up to the pew. It's not an actual pew, but it reminds you of one. There is something divine about AA, maybe because you know people have died for your sins. You describe how alcohol is messing up your life. You don't have a great description, because honestly, it hasn't messed up your life. You've done that yourself. You hold up your arm as a visual cue to your rock bottom. It's covered in a bandage from your wrist to your elbow. I tried to slip my wrist last night, but it's harder to do than it seems, and it really hurt, so I stopped before I could properly hurt myself. I barely made a dent, but I think I'm at rock bottom for just attempting it. You hold your arm up again. People look impressed. Maybe that's just in your head, but you feel it all the same. Then there is a keynote speaker. This is the best bit. Someone who has been sober a long time, either a year or 30, comes up and speaks about their journey to getting to where they are today. It's the best bit because of the stories before the sobriety. They talk about crossing the Iran border with coke up their ass and two friends getting thrown in the slammer there, fingernails pulled off, or fucking a prostitute and her filming it and then trying to blackmail them with it, sending copies to their wife and kids when they don't cough up the cash. Or pissing on their boss's computer at work in front of the interns and then losing their homes because of it. It was in LA. It wouldn't be that dramatic here, I don't think. Everyone's story is different, but they mostly involve pissing themselves in front of someone important. That's one of the cornerstones of AA. The keynote speakers always get caught up in the before stories, the glory of the before days, before they knew they had a problem. And then suddenly they have 2 minutes left and rush through. And so, yeah, I realized I needed help and joined the program, and now I'm the happiest I've ever been, thank you. Everybody claps. If you look around the room, there is usually someone crying. The MC then asks if anyone has a burning desire to drink. A burning desire, as opposed to a regular lukewarm one. Someone might raise their hand, usually shaking. In an uneven voice, they admit they want to drink. They are scared they will do it. Most times, they are the person who has been crying during the keynote. Their eyes are still red from it. You shouldn't judge, but you can't help yourself. The thought pathetic forces itself into your brain, and you let it stay there. It might make you a bad person, but it is a bit pathetic. No one says anything back besides the moderator who sings songs. Thank you for sharing. Chips are handed out. Plastic silver coins to commemorate time. Anyone here 24 hours sober? That's the entry-level chip. You shoot up your hand because you're near enough and you go up to collect your medal. Everyone claps as you return to your seat. The next level is 30 days. You have to wait 29 more days for another go at the podium. At the end, everyone holds hands, which is the least fun bit, having to touch some stranger's sweaty palm. The chant is recited. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Even if you're not an alcoholic, they're pretty good words to live by. It all lies in the wisdom to know the difference. That was way longer than I thought it would be. Okay, I need to take water. Okay. I'm going to talk about some other things in the book. I was planning another reading, but I think it's longer than that. Like, that was so long. I read the audiobook, and that felt longer. Okay, so in this book, I don't know if it's a big part of it. It's definitely the part that, like, when I did press, that they loved to make the headlines, that my mother had to read. But a big part of this book is when I was in LA, depressed out of my mind, making bad decisions, and I had sex with men for money. The Irish Independent chose that one as the headline after I told my mum, "I'll go buy the Irish Independent today. I've got an interview." So how it happened? Okay, my dad died, and then suddenly I was attracted to older men. Do we have any psychiatrists in? So it started. There was this comedian that I loved, who was a lot older than me, and I messaged him on Instagram a joke of his. And this is like at the beginning of Instagram, like this is 2014 or something. Like the sliding into DMs, I don't even think that was a term then. But he messaged back, and we just started talking, and he ended up flying me over to New York a couple times, and. You know, we had a little romance, and I just thought it was the most fun, exciting thing. I was like, here's this older guy with loads of money that's buying me shit. I feel incredible. And when that ended, I was going over to LA for this summer, and I Googled how to meet rich old men. And there's some websites for that. So I joined, there's one Seeking Arrangement, I joined that one. And after like a month of going on those type of dates, you kind of like learn what to do. And then I joined Tinder and I set the age 50 plus. And like, there's a lot of rich men in LA. I don't think you could do that here. I think if you set 50 plus, you probably just get people's dads. So don't do that. I mean, don't do this anyway. So I went on a lot of dates with these guys, had sex with a lot of these guys. And it was a weird, like, mental gymnastics that me and them played, because it is prostitution. But they felt it wasn't, because, you know, how they'd do the money, sometimes it would be, you know, they'd give you an amount every month, and sometimes they would just buy you shit, but it was about the money. I wouldn't have been having sex with them if it wasn't for the money, but we all kind of like played this pretend game that it wasn't about the money. Like, I had one guy, so a lot of times I wouldn't mention like the money, and just whatever they gave me. And I had one guy that would like change the amount every time. And I was like, is this performance based? Like, I had no idea. And I just wouldn't ask. But there was one really old guy, the oldest guy I went on a date with, he was 70. Which is pretty old. I was 24. And he did look good for 70, but not as good as what he thought he looked like. We went on one date. We did have sex. We went on one date, and he kept talking about how amazing he looked. And it's like, yeah, but 60's still old. Like, take 10 years. That's still old, man. And with him, I just, like, got down to business straight away, because I was like, I don't know how much time this guy has left. So I was like, I want $5,000 a month. And he said, yeah, fine, wrote me a check. And then we went into his bedroom to have sex. And he tried to not use a condom, which I thought was rich. I was like, come on, man, at this stage, like, men are still doing this. But then I thought, I was like, condoms probably weren't invented when he started having sex. Like, he probably thinks condoms are like PC gone mad. He's like, young people are putting plastic on penises. It's wild. But I made him put one on, and it lasted way too long. Which I was not happy with. I was like, you should let me know if you were using something here. I'd have asked for more. Then we went out on a date after that. And after the date, we went out for dinner. Afterwards, I was like, oh, order me an Uber to the club. I'm going to go meet my friends. And he was like, no, let's go back and have sex again. Which I did not sign up for that. I was like, first of all, is that even healthy for you to be doing? Like, heart-wise, surely not. So I said no. And he was sour. And I could tell, I just knew that he was going to try cancel that check. And so it felt like a real race against the against time. Because I knew he was going to do it. So like the next morning at like 7:50, I was outside the bank ready to get this cash. I was like, it needs to be quick, banging down on the thing. But the fucker cancelled it. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'm a victim in this. But to be fair to him, so he texts me and he goes, I've cancelled that check because I remember it. So he said, I don't have the appetite for him. Disgusting. But then he did say he did deposit $700, which is fair enough, you know. So I waited till that cleared and I was like, I'm not seeing you again. You've betrayed me. So that was the oldest, 70. Do you know, it's a weird thing. I did an interview on Ray Darcy, and when I was talking about this, about the men, and I felt like he was trying to angle that it was a negative thing, or trying to get me to say like they were bad men and I was taken advantage of, and I just don't feel that I was. I was fucked up, they were fucked up. I don't think there is good or bad. Like, I don't think they were bad men. I think they were like lonely men. I think some of them were entitled men, where they felt like they deserved this young, good-looking, I mean, can you call yourself that? I did it. Okay, how brave of me. Woman, but they knew they couldn't get that without money. So, you know, they played this mental gymnastics on themselves of like, oh, she's with me because she likes me and, you know, I just pay her rent. But I don't think any of them were bad men. I had a lot of good times with them. There was one date that I left halfway. It was only one time. He was this doctor, and he kept going on about how high his IQ was, which I just don't fuck with that at all. Like, I don't want to hear that. It's like some guy saying that he reads the news. Like, I don't want to know about it. And we'd ordered our starters. I'd ordered for my main Wagyu steak, which, like, I got really into Wagyu steak going on these dates, so I was buzzing for that. And then he like went under the table and he grabbed my wrist like this. And I was like, maybe he's checking like my heartbeat or whatever. Like, he's a doctor. I don't know, whatever, a pulse. But then he just like slowly started pressing harder and harder on it. And I just had no idea what was going on. I said nothing until it got like painful and I pulled away, and he was like, oh, I just wanted to see how much pain you could handle. And I was like, right, fair enough, absolutely no, like, I'm gonna have to leave now. So I left that date halfway before my Wagyu had come, and he couldn't, like, he had no idea what was going on. He was like, I went down the elevator and he was like, if you go, this is it, goodbye forever. And I was like, yes, that's what I want, I never want to see you again. But he was only the only one that was a bit weird. What other ones? Oh, there was one guy. Okay, so this guy, he wasn't American. He was Chinese. That will come back into it, okay? Not in a weird racist way. It was just not being American. We had sex. He wrote me a check for $1,000. Pretty nice. But he wrote it in calligraphy because he had taken a calligraphy class, and he was like really proud of it. Like, he presented it to me, and it was just kind of cute how proud he was. So I was like, oh yeah, I love how you've looped those L's. Like, really, really nice. And then I went and I deposited on the automatic thing. Like, you just put in the check into your bank account. And then I got a phone call the next day saying my bank account was frozen. They thought it was fraud. And they were like, the only way to get your bank account unfrozen is to have him come down and verify that, you know, he's given you this money. And I was like, oh, fuck this. But after that old guy, I was so worried about, you know, my checks now. So I called him up and I was like super aggressive, where I was like, you have betrayed me. You have fraud, they're saying. And he was like doing his grocery shopping. And he was like, can I figure this out in like 20 minutes? And I was like, I have no money to eat. Like, I was so dramatic about it. So he came down to the bank and it was me and him sitting in there with a branch manager. As he told her that I did some gardening. That was the payment. She didn't even ask what the payment was for. Like, he just panicked and he was like, she did some gardening. And I'm there in fake nails, like a mini dress. And I was like, yeah, I planted some rose bushes. And the woman was just like, yeah, it was just the writing on this that flagged the system. And I was like, oh, fuck you, man. I'm not fucking calligraphy. And then he got like, I think he just got embarrassed about it because he, you know, it's, I don't know if she figured out what was going on or what, but he got really embarrassed. And so he felt the need to like exert himself. So he started talking about wanting to open up a bank account. Like absolutely a separate meeting. Like, I did not need to be there for it because he was like, oh, I'm not an American citizen, but I do have these assets. And then he's listing his assets. And she was like, oh, you can get a good bank account. And I was like, oh, I got to get back to my weeds. So that was that guy. Oh, okay, I'll tell one more. So this is like the weirdest first date I went on. It was this guy that I'd been talking to for a few weeks. I met him on Seeking Arrangements. He'd been married. He'd left his wife, come out as bisexual, had a boyfriend now, and was looking for a girlfriend. And at that stage of my life, like, absolutely loved that kind of drama. I was like, I'm in, man, I'm in. But he talked weird. Like, he'd say things like, he was like, I want to adorn you in the finest silks and silvers. Which I was like, is this Great Gatsby? Like, who talks like this? So he picked me up for the date. This is our first date. In this, like, wrecked car. And he was wearing a velvet blazer and slippers. And it was morning. It was like a Sunday morning. And he said we were going to brunch. And then he brings me to this house up in like the canyon. And we get in there and there's about 40 people in there. I'm the youngest by about 30 years. There's all these people. I have no idea who they are. It's someone's house. There's like a brunch set up. I had to do a tour of the house with all these old ladies. Because the woman made wine. And so we had to go look at her like grapes or whatever. And I was like, what the hell's going on here? And there was all this brunch food, just everything, pancakes, French toast. It was amazing, the spread. But there was like whipped cream on everything. And I hate whipped cream. So when I was getting my plate, I was like, oh, can I get mine without whipped cream? And people gasped. And it turned out it was like a business brunch for the launch of like the whipped cream brand. And I was like, mate, why have you invited me to this and also given me no backstory on this? And so people were horrified that I had said no to the whipped cream. And the whole car ride back, he was just like, I can't believe you made that faux pas about the whipped cream. And then when he was dropping me off, he called me a kitten and asked me to purr for him. So I didn't see him again. I'm going to read one more chapter, but it's going to be long. I met this guy on Seeking Arrangements, this guy Mark, and I was obsessed with him. Like, whatever it was, like, I just bought into him. Honestly, I still think about him now sometimes. I'll be like, what the hell is Mark up to? Wasn't even his real name, Mark. I don't think I gave good backstory there. It'll do. Okay, just give me a minute. Give me a minute. Talk among yourselves. Okay, okay, after this, we're going to do like a Q&A. And I really hope someone has a question. Otherwise, it's going to be really awkward. Oh, where is this? You guys can ask anything as well, by the way, because if people haven't read the book, it's like really graphic. Like every interview I've done, people are like, were you not uncomfortable being that honest? And I was like, well, not until now that you've said that. Okay. It's going to be worth the wait. Okay. I did not do this on purpose. So I didn't write the book in like, what's the U tense? Like the second point of view. I'm not a writer, guys. I don't know. What is that? I'm thinking second tense, but obviously it's not tense. Second person. Oh, so close, you know, just one word away. So this chapter is also in second person. But the book is not. I've just randomly picked the two that are. It's just those two. It's not insane. Okay. You've spent 3 months taking advantage of men. You think you know what it looks like. Wielding power is so all-enforcing you can't miss it. Until you do. Your first date with Mark is in a seafood restaurant in Santa Monica. He has already cancelled on you once, so you're not sure if he will show. You arrive after spending the day on the beach, your hair knotty from the salt water. You are wearing jean shorts and Birkenstocks, your bikini straps slipping down your shoulders. You look out of place among the business suits and high heels. He orders you a drink, something you've never heard of, but when you taste it, it becomes your favorite drink. He asks you questions about yourself. He asks them in a way that makes you feel like he's the first person to ever ask them. He said he was 42 on his profile. He now tells you he's 50. He says it in a way that makes you like him even more. I don't fuck on the first date, you tell him. Yeah, I do. You've grown confident from your months of first dates. You know how to communicate what you want. That's perfect, he says, smiling back at you, like what you said was his idea. Within 30 minutes, you are drunk on him. Before an hour is up, he checks his watch. I've got to go now, but this has been great. I'll call you. All you can manage is a smile in return. You're afraid to open your mouth, afraid of what desire will come spilling out. So you just nod. He calls you up later that evening when you're home in your apartment in downtown LA. I'm over in your neck of the woods for a business dinner. Let's meet for a late night drink. It's not a question. You quickly shower and do your makeup, drawing your lips in red. Lipstick is something you can never get your head around. Your hands apply it too shakily, so it's all over your mouth. You use a cotton bud to clean it off, but take off too much. You scrub your lips in frustration and try again, watching a YouTube tutorial to guide you. It still doesn't look right. The bar will be dim, you think to yourself, and grab your bag and leave. When you see him, you immediately want to fuck him. Your whole body is on fire. The bar is closing when you both arrive. He convinces them to stay open for just one more drink. You'll find out very soon how good he is at convincing people to do things. You talk, but mainly listen. He tells you he has a girlfriend. I hope that isn't a problem. You seem cool, so I assume it isn't. You swallow the problem. I guess it's fine, yeah. You both keep talking. You drink up every word he says. He speaks with an authority and awareness you find tantalizing. You lean forward every time he says a word, desperate to feel it all. The bartender comes over to the table. We really got to shut. All the chairs are up on the wooden tables, and most of the lights are out. You ask him if he wants to come back to your place, because technically this is the second date. He says yes. He controls the tempo, the movement, the actions. He steers you to a shape he wants. You give in so easily to his control, it makes you wonder if you've been waiting for this your whole life. you have the best sex you've ever had. Every other fuck feels like stabilizer sex, and he has taken off the training wheels. When you come, you look straight into his eyes. A bolt shoots through your body. You think you are in love with him. When it's over, he strokes your hair as he sits up on the bed. Let's go on a drive to an ATM. I want to give you some money. You don't need to do that, you tell him. I do. I want to be good to you. Every time I've done this before, I give $600 each time. It's not about the money, but the money is important. I know you're smart enough to get it. You smile, not getting it. You drive around with him to a few ATMs. His card doesn't work in any of them. It must be because it's a new card, he tells you. I'll get you back next time. He never does, and you never bring it up. Really, you like he didn't give you money. It makes you feel different to the other girls. If he doesn't give you money, it means it isn't about the money. You see Mark a couple times a week. You talk to him every day. You are desperate for every interaction with him. No matter what you get, you want more. You are infatuated with every part of him, especially the part of him that makes you feel seen. When he fucks you, you feel connected in a way you've never felt before. I don't think anyone has ever seen me how you see. I don't think anyone has ever seen me how you do. You pierce right into my gut. When I'm with you, I feel completely exposed. The words just spill out of you. I love that, he always says. I love your power. He always speaks about your power. Even back then, you know he is the one with the true power. Any power you have is only a result of him giving it to you. How grateful you feel for getting even a drop. Mark's name isn't really Mark, but you never ask what it actually is. You don't need to know. You know what you both have transcends any of that bullshit. Mark, Mark, oh yes, Mark, you scream from your bed. I did not know this chapter had so much sex when I was picking it to read out. He texts you all the time. He knows you fuck other men when he's not around, but he likes to check in to make sure you're still thinking about him. What guy is it tonight? Tell me everything about him. I'll be over in an hour. Go for a run and don't shower after, smiley face. Tell me your darkest fantasy. You know I'll never judge you. I have to cancel on tonight. I haven't seen my daughter in 2 weeks, smiley face. I can tell I don't have your full attention, so let's chat some other time, smiley face. You're working when he sends that, as a hostess in a whiskey bar. You immediately run to the bathroom, leaving a queue of people standing at the entrance, waiting to be seated. No, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. Mark isn't a good person, and you know that deep down. It's part of the attraction. You love how easily he controls you, how easily you let yourself be controlled. There's no such thing as bad or good, he tells you, just people trying to get what they want. What do you want? He asks you. You reply. He laughs. Well, then you're one of the lucky ones, getting exactly what you want. He comes to your bar one night with his friend. It's a high-end place. They serve just whiskey straight, with hand-chipped ice. People have to ring a hidden bell to get in. Mark kisses you roughly when he walks in. It took us a fucking hour to get here, he says with annoyance, like LA's traffic is your fault. And you say, oh, sorry? They sit on the patio and drink whiskeys that are $60 a pour. You bring them hot towels, leaning on the arm of Mark's chair to talk. You are delighted to meet his friend. Surely that means there's something real here, if he wants to introduce you to him. Surely this means what you want it to mean. When you want something very badly, it's so easy to imagine it to be true. When you bring the bill, he passes it to his friend, who pays. Give her a nice tip, he instructs, and he does. They drive back to your apartment with you in the back seat. You have to see where she lives, he says to his friend when he pulls up at your building. His friend hesitates at the same time you do, but still, you all get out of his Jeep. You wonder if you're going to have to fuck his friend. You decide you will do it, if he wants you to. You decide it's not really your choice at all. Isn't it so bohemian? Mark says, his words bellowing in the open apartment. They don't even have doors in here. You hope Connell isn't at home, rolling his eyes from his bed. Mark's friend awkwardly looks around, not moving from his spot at the entrance. Yeah, very cool. We should head, though. Mark pulls you closer to him and sticks his tongue down your throat. The only sound you hear is his friend coughing. You hear him and pull in closer. You feel embarrassed for his friend, but glad he is a witness and not a player. Glad Mark is choosing you, just you. You catch eyes with a friend and he shrugs. He gets it. Sometimes Mark comes straight to your apartment and you fuck. He complains about your soap brand when he takes a shower and you tell him you'll replace it. Other times he brings you out on dates. He's never nervous about being caught. I don't know anyone who lives in East LA, so we're fine, he tells you. You nod, like it's the only thing you're worried about too. Mark has been cheating his whole life, he tells you. I know you're too smart to judge that. He is so sure about parts of you that you're hazy on. It feels very welcoming to have someone tell you who you are when you're so uncertain. One night, he pulls up at your apartment in his sports car with the roof down. He drives erratically, sometimes stopping in the middle of the street to say something to you. The cars around him beep aggressively, but it doesn't seem to concern him. He pulls up to an Italian restaurant in Silver Lakes and hands his keys to the valet. I know everyone's staring at us. Old guy with money, hot young girl. You can tell he gets off on it. You do too. He asks for a table outside. He orders for you, but picks exactly right. Oysters and steak, medium rare, and a bottle of pink champagne, he tells the waiter. You've had this food 100 times with other men, but you really taste it with him. Afterwards, you take out a cigarette, shaking your lighter when it won't produce a flame. I don't mind if you smoke, but I don't find it that interesting. You quickly stub out the cigarette. You desperately want to be interesting. You talk with him about politics and desire and insecurities. You say how unsure you are in your future. He assures you that everything you need to figure out is inside of you. You smile when he says that. He fills up your empty glass. I've never met someone like you, you say. He laughs. People tell me that a lot. I've just figured out who I am and what I want. People are drawn to that. You look away, embarrassed. You don't want to be people. You want to be something he's never had. You want to be special. You look at him across the candlelit table, your cheeks hot from the warm Southern California night. I'm not crazy, am I? You ask him. We really do have something unique, don't we? He ignores your questions, but hones in on your want. I wish I could bring you into the bathroom, bend you over and suck on your pussy. You instantly contort your brain to be what he suggests. You slide your legs apart under the table, you open your mouth and stick your thumb inside, slowly sucking it. He smiles. Good girl. You look into his eyes. You know you are smart, but you also know he is smarter than you. A part of you can see how he is playing you. Another part of you likes being played. Okay, it's just one more page. I was gonna stop there. Okay. He fills up your glass again. My cock is rock hard, baby. He stands up to beckon for the bill. You stare at the bulge in his pants. See? Now everyone else can see how much I want you. You laugh. You never want the night to end. Mark gives you money when he feels like it. He likes to pay your rent the day before it's due, right when you're down to the wire and feel sweat running down your back. My hero, you text, because you know that's what he wants to hear. His assistant drives to your apartment on the last Saturday of the month and passes an envelope from the window of his Beetle. You laugh as you take it, but he just smiles, embarrassed. Have fun, he yells, speeding off. You wonder how often these drop-offs happen. Maybe it's written into his job description. As the months go by, Mark slices off deeper parts of you, parts you didn't even know you could give. You feel special every time he asks for a little bit more. He really wants me, you think, carving off new chunks to give him. When he tells you his fantasy, 3 months in, you want to say yes before he can even finish his sentence. You know how you tell me about the other men you fuck, and you nod because you do. It turns me on when you talk about it. What if I got to watch you with another man? Watch him fuck you until you come. Watch him use you to pleasure himself. Your body betrays you. When he says it, you make a face without realizing, because really, you don't want to do that. You don't want another man. You only really want him. He can sense this. And then, of course, afterwards, I would take you in my arms and hold you and kiss you. And then you'd truly be mine. You like this idea. Yeah, maybe that could work. He smiles and repeats himself. Then you'd truly be mine. You decide you love this idea. It becomes your idea. He tells you to set up a Craigslist profile. Craigslist, that website you've used in the past to find apartments. The Craigslist killer. Women have been murdered in these classifieds. Specify a black man, he tells you. That would be so much hotter. You don't ask him why. You get 80 messages from the profile. You read them out loud to your friends when you're all drinking beers in your living room. The room fills with laughter as dick pics flood your inbox. One guy tells you he coaches high school football. I've never done this before. He sounds believable, but who ends up by accident on a Craigslist threesome ad? Then again, not everybody ends up there by choice. My idea, you repeat to yourself every time you feel unsure. You present a short list of guys to Mark. You don't really want to do this, but it's your idea, and you want to please him. Pleasing him pleases you. Still, he can feel your apprehension. He's very good at reading people. You don't seem that excited about this, which is disappointing. You don't want to disappoint him. You make an argument about how much you want it, how hot it is, how much your body desires it. It would be the hottest thing to me if he fucked you raw and came inside you, he says. Oh, well, yeah, I guess, except that's really risky. I don't want to have sex with a stranger from Craigslist without a condom. Mark always uses a condom with you, so you're sure he gets it. Within a week, he has you agreeing to no condom. You never do it. When it becomes obvious it's not going to happen, you realize he never really wanted to do it. He just wanted to know you would. That power, you get it. It's addictive. To control someone is something. To be controlled is something else. They are two sides to the same coin. There can be opposites that are the exact same. Do you like it? He asks, while leaving red marks on your ass. Yes, yes, please, yes, you moan. He didn't take control away from me. I gave it to him willingly. I wanted him to make every decision for me, from what I smelled like, to what I wore, to who I wanted to fuck. I wanted him to decide what I liked and who I was, because having to choose it for myself was overwhelming. I could begin the thought, I want to, and then my brain would cut out. It just went blank. I couldn't decide the ending to that sentence, so I was grateful for him taking over. You want to please me. And I smiled, relieved at my fate being decided by someone else, at becoming a you instead of a me. Okay, yes, great, thank you. I want to please you. Once back in Amsterdam, I take out my phone and delete his information, taking away my choice. I know if I ever said one more word to him, my whole heart would spill out. I know how much he'd enjoy that game, because that's all it was to him, a game, and me, the willing player, twisting to his every move. Matthew, his real name was Matthew. I heard it from his phone and it was connected to the Bluetooth in the car. I acted like I didn't notice, and he let me away with not noticing. Matthew and Mark, one half of the evangelists. Oh God, oh God, oh God.
Thanks for listening to the ILFD podcast. International Literature Festival Dublin is a Dublin City Council initiative kindly supported by the Arts Council.